Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This week on The Wheelhouse. Baby bonds. And a little later, the end of the COVID emergency. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse, the show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond, right here. Last week, Connecticut officials finally gave the thumbs up to baby bonds, reaching an agreement on how to finance its long-awaited program dedicated to reinvesting money in underserved communities. Officials hope the program will help break cycles of generational poverty. It's on track to begin in July, after being in political limbo for quite some time. At a recent news conference, State Treasurer Eric Russell said this.
This is sending a resounding message that your future can be bright regardless of what zip code you are born in and regardless of what family you are born into.
And for more on what it'll mean for Connecticut residents and why it took so long, joined by three great guests. First of all, in studio to my left, Ginny Monk, the children's issues and housing reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Ginny, thank you so much for coming into the studio today.
Thanks for having me, Frankie.
Yeah, good to have you on and have you aboard. And on Zoom, two great guests. We have Diedrich Asante Mohammed, Chief of Organizing Policy and Equity for the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. Good morning, Diedrich.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. And finally, Afronim Abiu, Senior Research Associate for the Urban Institute. I'm going to do that one more time to make sure that I introduce Afronim. Afronim Abiu, the Senior Research Associate for the Urban Institute. Good morning, and thank you for coming on, Afronim.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
You can join the conversation if you're listening in today, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677. Diedrich, you get the first question. Before we zoom in on Connecticut, in basic terms, what are baby bonds and how do they typically work?
Well, I will, you know, most basically, baby bonds are an investment that oftentimes the state or some entity puts forward with a newborn child that then is allowed to kind of grow in value until they are able to claim it. Oftentimes, I think in Connecticut's case, somewhere between the age of 18 and 30. And, you know, it's an idea that I've heard Jesse Jackson say this oftentimes, that in a capitalist society, it's very challenging when you have no capital. So it's the idea of allowing all Americans, or particularly lower income Americans, have some capital when they reach adulthood. And the belief is that this will help them move forward in their kind of economic, socioeconomic development.
Afronim, who are baby bonds going to help the most, would you say?
Thanks for the question. I would say baby bonds are going to help people who reach adulthood and come from low wealth families. Really the greatest source of wealth inequality comes from inheritance, and the idea that regardless of the family that you're born into, you can have some pot of funds that you can use for wealth building activities like starting a business, buying a home, going to college without accruing debt. Those are the families that, or those are the young adults that would really get a leg up from this program.
And how did the concept of baby bonds kind of come to be? Is it a relatively new policy idea?
Well, you know, economist Derek Hamilton is really the engineer about the concept, but he's pointed out that it's not really a new idea. And people like Thomas Paine back in the late 1700s talked about the idea of having a national fund. And Derek really describes it as a, you know, quote, birthright to capital for all children. Kind of like there's an opportunity for people at when they retire to access Social Security. What about having something so young adults can get a start in life?
And then finally, just really quickly, Afronima, the idea is, I would understand that you'd have an opportunity, like you said, pay for college, down payment on a house, that kind of thing. What else?
Yeah, that's right. Down payment on a house, starting a business potentially, going to college without debt or some other type of educational training. Some proposals have included retirement, investing in a retirement account or investing in some other account that will yield interest so that wealth can grow over time.
Let's come back to Connecticut, where we are filming, or rather taping the show today. And Ginny Monk, who is to my left, how's this program going to work in Connecticut?
Yeah, so kids who are covered by Husky will be eligible. They'll be automatically enrolled. The state will invest $3,200 for about 15,000 kids. It's projected to grow to between 11,000 and 24,000 per year, and that's for babies who are born after July 1st, 2023.
And then how's it going to be funded? That's the big thing, right? That was a source of consternation for the last 2 years.
That is the big thing. So essentially, the state is going to take about $381 million from when the teachers' pension fund was restructured and use that for the, sort of the initial funding. And then the idea is that it'll be invested and grow to reach the $600 million that they want to see invested over 12 years.
But the big issue that we saw here was an issue of interest payments and things like that. And I do want to get to that in a second. I do want to get to that in a little bit. First of all, I want to tell folks that if they have questions about baby bonds, they can join the conversation. 888-720-9677. 888-720-9677. Staying at the state level, I want to talk about the State Bond Commission, their role in implementing the baby bonds program. Can you kind of walk us through that effort?
Yeah. So initially when former Treasurer Sean Wooden had proposed this program, it had automatic approval. So often when there's bonding passed, the Bond Commission has to approve it unless it has this particular automatic approval. That was removed sort of at the last minute, and the funding needed to go through the Bond Commission. Now, the Bond Commission is pretty heavily influenced by the governor. So the governor chairs it, his budget office sets the agenda, he appoints some of the members. So we just kind of saw that the Bond Commission just didn't take it up. So it didn't get funding initially when it was supposed to.
And that bonding process, how does it work? You said the governor's in charge. They have this kind of Justice League kind of setup at the Capitol where there's a table and everybody sits around the governor. Can you just give us an idea of how the bonding process sort of works?
Yeah, so the legislature passes a bonding package every year, and then that goes through the Bond Commission. So the Bond Commission approves the bonding, which then the treasurer invests, and that's how these things get funded. So there's sort of an extra step after the legislature approves it.
Afronima, in a report for the Urban Institute, you outline six components that ensure baby bonds will live up to their promise of addressing racial wealth inequities. Can you walk us through what those are? And to your knowledge, does Connecticut's program have some of those components?
Sure, we're happy to do that. So the six components we talk about include universal eligibility, and automatic enrollment, I would add. So children automatically being enrolled for a baby bonds program at birth. We also note that it should be financially progressive, that account deposits are based on household wealth, which typically is not available. So some other proxies use like household income, children getting larger deposits if their families have a lower income or wealth position. Third, flexible use of funds so that once the child reaches adulthood, they can decide what is the best use of the funds for them, whether, as I mentioned before, it's post-secondary education, home ownership, or some other opportunity. Fourth, the baby bond program would be publicly funded, financed by the government, so that there's opportunity for a substantial contribution to be made, and it's not dependent on families having to contribute in some type of, for example, like a match savings account. Fifth, there should be a substantial endowment so that when the child reaches adulthood, they're able to use this funding as a vehicle to access additional assets or avoid debt. And then finally, the recipient of the funding is the child. It's the individual who gets the funds. It's not the family. They are the ultimate beneficiaries. So I would say that the program in Connecticut certainly meets many of these six tenants. For example, the funds it is a substantial endowment. I would say it's one of the bigger ones that we've seen in looking at some of the other proposals across the country. There aren't any additional annual contributions. I would say most of the other proposals don't have that either. You know, obviously that would be great to ensure that there's additional funding, but at least the endowment itself is pretty substantial. All those other things like automatic enrollment, the funds being flexible, it is obviously publicly funded. All those things are components that are included in the proposal for Connecticut.
And now we're going to bring in Dietrich on this. Do you have any thoughts on Connecticut's program based on what Ginny and Afronima have just told us?
Well, yeah, I do. I have several thoughts. I think, well, and one thing I want to highlight is I also, you know, the excitement to me around baby bonds is that it is designed to deal with wealth inequality, right? I think we saw, you know, arguably 30s, 40s through the 60s, there was this idea of kind of income supplementation as a way to fight poverty. And we saw, let's say, in particular, the African-American community, we saw like 1959, Black child poverty rates was like over 50%, which is kind of amazing to think about. And it's gone down to around 20%. And so there was some success there, but using, you know, this, you know, income supplements to help people pay for food, these types of things. But there was a recognition that there's also wealth inequality and that people don't just need income. They need some type of assets and wealth. Sheridan's book, Assets and the Poor in 1980, really focused on that and had these idea of kind of children's savings accounts. And then, you know, William Darity, Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton kind of improved on that idea with these baby bonds for addressing the racial wealth divide. And I think the exciting thing about what's happening here in Connecticut is we're seeing this implemented, and we're seeing it implemented at a significant level. I did a critique of children's savings accounts about 5 years ago, noting that most of these children's savings accounts were for around $50, and that $50 was having very minimal, would have a very minimal impact even after 20 years of a kind of return on making the impact on a family's life. But I do believe that this, I think it's around what, $3,000, $3,200 or something like that start, that people estimate will grow from 10 to 24,000 can have a much more substantial impact. Though I will note that Hamilton and Darity's original ideas for these type of baby bonds was 50,000 for the poorest, right? Because there is this huge racial wealth divide, right? Median wealth for Blacks, not including depreciating assets in 2019, was $9,000. For whites was 160,000. So I think this is an important step, but obviously this alone would not bridge the racial wealth divide nationally or in Connecticut, where I've seen it estimated that Connecticut has some of the highest racial economic inequality in the country.
How do you think baby bonds will work in Connecticut? You can join the conversation. Join the conversation. Let us know if you think it can help close that racial wealth gap. 888-720-9677. That's the number to call, 888-720-9677. And joining us now on the line from Southington is Jeff, who's going to make a comment. Go ahead, Jeff. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, Frankie. Hey, thanks for having me on. So as a retired CPA who's been doing taxes and helping people with their investing for about 40 years, I have some comments about the program. I think the goals are very, very worthy. So my concerns are, though, that with the much publicized tax gap that the IRS has talked about, where Their estimates are that up to $1 trillion is lost every year due to tax cheating. My concern about a program like this is that there needs to be an enforcement mechanism, some type of auditing, so that the money is used for its intended purposes. And I know that we're still in the early stages of the program that hasn't been addressed yet. Because, you know, as we know, it could be very, very easy, you know, once a child turns 18, that the money could be used for a purpose other than what it is intended for. My second concern is that with very, very low levels of financial literacy, I would love to see a mandatory program enacted by the state legislature so that all high school students have to take a financial literacy class, which would help them to better spend and save and invest that money. I know that's being talked about in the legislature this year. That would be great if that could get passed. And so, because one of the main things I have seen over my 40 years of doing taxes and helping people with their investing is that a lot of people who save money in an account like this, whether it's an IRA, but especially in their 401ks, when they transfer from job to job or just stay in their current job, they often take that money out long before they get to retirement, and they spend it on, you know, things other than things they really need. You know, they want to go on vacation. They want to add on to their house, and they drain their 401ks and they pay the taxes and the penalties. So that is another concern. My last concern is that with this report from Yale recently, Jeff Sonnenfeld, he talked about how incredibly poorly the state was investing its own pension money, where we have lost billions of dollars because we did not invest in low-cost index funds. So I'm wondering how the money is going to get invested. That's another one of my concerns.
Thank you. And thank you for sharing your concerns today, Jeff. I appreciate it. Jeff from Southington joining us on the Wheelhouse this morning. He's sharing his concerns. He's worried about the money being spent properly. Anybody want to make a comment on that?
I do want to just address the concern on financial literacy. As the baby bonds program is going to be implemented, it does have a requirement that participants take a financial literacy training before they can access the funds.
Thank you very much for that, Ginny. Go ahead, Diedrich.
And I'll just jump on to the financial education component. I mean, most studies I've seen that, most studies that I've seen that look at financial education, financial literacy, note that it has its strongest effect when it actually is tied to some type of asset building program or some type of income coming in. So I think it being tied to this program will actually, because I think financial education just in general, theoretical, has very little, people retain very little. But the idea that it's being connected to actually assets that they will be getting, I think will make it the program that much stronger. And two, I think there was some concern about how people might take the money and use it for vacations. But from my understanding, and you all can correct me or add on to this, that, you know, there are clear ways that the money can be used, and vacations is not one of them.
Jenny, 2 years ago, Connecticut becomes the first state in the nation to pass the Baby Bonds Initiative. But as we alluded to earlier, it took a while. It took 2 years, obviously, for this funding to come through. Interest payments, what's the deal? You were able to highlight this in reporting where you found the governor's office led a, quote, campaign of quiet but fierce opposition to baby bonds.
Yeah, so the interest payments were one of the concerns that this new funding structure seeks to address. It just seeks to avoid sort of a lot of those payments that would have cost the state some money. But there were, you know, a handful of other things that the Lamont administration expressed as a concern. There were some concerns from DSS that about how exactly they would track these children and make sure that they were able to get the money when they turned 18. You know, how it would work if people go on and off Husky, which is fairly common. And, you know, I think the other thing is that Lamont's administration wanted to see programs that would help kids now rather than in 18 years. And the politics of that were all quite complicated, with Sean Wooden, who sort of championed the program initially, announcing that he wasn't going to do another term as treasurer. There were a lot of sort of behind-the-scenes conversations between the Lamont administration and the Black and Puerto Rican caucus, which has expressed support for baby bonds. So there were a lot of folks involved, and it was a very complicated sort of interaction.
Well, Franima, off of that, we talk about the politics of this. What are the challenges putting policies like this into practice?
Well, we've certainly seen an example of the challenges. I think it can be difficult to get policies like this passed. And from what I understand, sometimes the framing of the policy is something that can get that bipartisan support. So, for example, I know in Connecticut, they talked about the idea that this baby bonds proposal would be something that would help the state's economy so that, for example, the people who ultimately receive the funds in adulthood, they have to buy a home in the state or start a business in the state. So that's further investing in the economy of the state. So that's something that helps to get that bipartisan support. So a lot of times framing is something that's certainly a component of it. And of course, dealing with the issue of how to finance it.
Yeah, I want to get into more of that political framing and why something like this, something so important to support children born into poverty, would be so politicized. We'll do that next. You're listening to The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about baby bonds in Connecticut, specifically why it took so long to figure out how to finance it. Still with me. In studio, to my left, Ginny Monk, the children's issues and housing reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. On Zoom, Diedrick Asante Muhammad, who is the chief of organizing policy and equity at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. And Ophronima Bew, senior research associate for the Urban Institute. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for staying with us through the break. Diedrick, talking about this a little bit before that last break. Given what Ginny mentioned about financing baby bonds in Connecticut, are there concerns about baby bonds becoming this political football?
Well, I mean, I think everything has become a political football, and obviously spending is always is even more so a political football. And I do think, you know, part of the political challenge around baby bonds is that it's putting forth money today for returns in the future. And that can be hard for politicians to see the immediate gratitude that this would provide or how it will help them with the next election cycle. But it actually does help deal with the problem that is much more of a long-term problem. Again, you know, we talked a little bit about earlier about this idea of kind of income supplements versus the idea of wealth development. And income supplements probably the reason it got passed quicker is it was more immediate and could get more political capital from it. But the idea of wealth development, I mean, this is very smart. You're putting forward $3,200 that then will turn into, you know, $10,000 to $24,000 and have a much greater impact. So I think in many ways, it's a intelligent cost saving way or a cheaper way of dealing with a problem, because oftentimes, too, we don't calculate the expense on society of having so many children come into adulthood in complete asset poverty. So it's hard politically because you can't just show that immediately. But I think practically, and if we can have this program go and continue and manifest itself, so in 20 years we really see the results, I think it's going to show what an effective policy it was.
Yeah, and I'm going to direct this question, this next question to you, Diedrich, but anybody can answer it if they want afterwards. We're looking really at politics in general, how they affect efforts to address poverty. But that last listener question that we had or comment, we're talking about financial literacy. We're talking about money being spent on vacations, potentially when children born into poverty turn 18. Why is there such this, I guess, political, but why are there so many questions as to how this money will be spent and this concern for people that have been particularly disadvantaged in life?
Well, we've demonized the poor for generations, going way back. I'm old now, but way back when I was a child, I remember the whole attack with the idea of the welfare queen and the idea that the reason poor people are poor is because of the bad decisions they made, instead of the reason that most communities find themselves in asset poverty and low income generation after generation is policies that had kept them out of opportunity. So I think, you know, that idea is still with us presently, and it's potent in political debates and discussions. And I think this program, will show that actually when you give people actually access to capital, again, it's not going to make all these children who were born in poverty millionaires or completely economic stability, because it's still only $10,000 or $24,000, right? And people know in the, you know, kind of makeup of your economic life, you know, that only goes so far. But again, if the median wealth of Blacks nationwide is $9,000 and they're getting $10,000, you can see that is a significant increase, and hopefully can help households across Connecticut, low wealth households across Connecticut, take a step forward in their economic journey.
I want to talk a bit more about the role of baby bonds in closing the racial wealth gap. Essentially, maybe baby bonds may be separate from baby bonds or Franima. What kind of wealth building policies and programs do we have out there? Like maybe the reparations proposal out of California, also hearing today about efforts in New York City to help children that lost parents and for COVID. Not necessarily sure how that helps children born into poverty, but help me with ideas of these wealth building policies to support people of color.
Yeah, I'd love for Diedrich to share more about reparations. I know you've written a lot about that, but yeah, absolutely. Reparations, the idea to compensate Black Americans or descendants of slavery for the lasting effects of that and the asset stripping that happened. That's one. There's also ideas around helping people have access to home ownership, whether that's some type of down payment support. I mean, there's other things that would need to be dealt with to support that. For example, there's research that colleagues at Urban have published that note that there's issues with the valuation of homes owned by Black families, and obviously the Brookings Institute's published research on that as well. Also retirement programs, so some type of retirement accounts, IDAs, or individual accounts that would help with matching incentives and supporting and protecting Social Security. Also small business, some type of tax credit programs. Those are some of the proposals that are out there. I think there could be more, of course, and I think baby bonds is a great step that is more of a bold proposal as well.
And is it okay if I jump in for a second?
Oh, absolutely. You don't have to ask me. Get in there, Diedrich.
Very good. And, you know, I think one exciting thing about the Connecticut program or the opportunities in Connecticut is to build off of this program, right? I mean, because, again, you know, the wealth divide and racial economic inequality, you know, goes beyond baby bonds, but it's a great building block. So if there can, just as they're tying financial literacy to this program, if they could, you know, have tutoring programs or nonprofits that are focused on education for youth to focus on these youth. And so they actually are, you know, achieving academically as much as possible. Job training programs, that's an important, well, job, not just job training and placement, because you can be trained for a job, but if you're not placed in a job, it's not that helpful. But, you know, I think building off of this program can really make then the success of this program even greater. So I think there's a lot of opportunity here.
Afronima just mentioned something about the valuation of homes. Data Haven in Connecticut just recently released this, and I don't know how much it speaks to it, but 63% of black households in Hartford live in structures built before 1960. So certainly something I want to watch in the future when we talk about the potential for home ownership programs that Afronima did there. And Diedrich speaking about opportunities to maybe build off of baby bonds in Connecticut. And zooming out now a bit from baby bonds, briefly, Diedrich, why do we have so much wealth inequality in this country? How did we get here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, oftentimes I hear people say, how in 2023 are we still dealing with these issues of racism, you know, racial inequality, what have you? And I always just try to put forth, because I think there's what I call an illusion that race and racism is about personal prejudice, when I think it is much more about economics, right? And that's the challenge in this country, is that the foundation of this country was based on wealth accumulation for some at the expense of others, right? So taking the land of this country from indigenous people and making that the wealth of, you know, white settlers coming, or making black people the actual literal wealth of white people coming here, and, you know, that. And then there was, for, you know, generations of, you know, redlining, of not hiring, of hiring in a racially discriminatory way. So all of these things have developed a racial wealth divide that doesn't get solved by itself. We have to have the investments in order to bridge it. Dr. King talked about this often, that it's one thing to take down a colored sign by a water fountain. It's another thing to invest the billions of dollars needed to actually move people up. And I think, you know, this baby bonds program is a small step forward, but an important step forward in actually putting some of that investment that has been lacking for generations in dealing with the racial wealth divide.
In Connecticut, among the worst in the nation when it comes to wealth inequality, as we've mentioned several times in the show, a very dubious distinction for the nutmeg constitution state land of steady habits. Ginny, are baby bonds going to close this gap? What do we know about the projected economic impact of the program?
Yeah, I mean, we know that the money is expected to grow quite a bit for each child. And I think one thing to maybe make explicit in this conversation is we've used a lot of words like build wealth. And really what that means is that these kids will be able to become adults and say, you know, maybe my family didn't have the money to help me buy a house or go to college, but now I can do those things, and those things sort of build on one another, right? So if you're able to go to college and get a good paying job, maybe you're able to afford a down payment later. And I think these are the things that, you know, when we're talking about building wealth, these are the opportunities that a lot of folks have because their family can give them money or started a savings account for them when they were born.
Let me be nice to Connecticut, maybe. Afronima and Diedrich, as far as we know, is Connecticut the first to pass a baby bonds initiative through the state legislature?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. And there's other proposals that are out there. Hopefully they'll be passed and Connecticut won't be alone. Of course, we know that D.C. passed as well.
Yeah, keep going. Sorry, I don't know if you cut off there, Afronima.
Connecticut. So it's been introduced in other places.
Yeah, can you compare Connecticut's program to others out there, like the one you mentioned in D.C.?
Sure, absolutely. You know, there have been so many proposals that are out there, including, we haven't really talked about the federal proposal, which was reintroduced by Senator Booker and Representative Presley, but the other state and local proposals. I would say there are, you know, definitely some similarities in terms of flexible use of funds is a big one. You know, I would say the state proposals are limiting eligibility to the lowest income families. The federal proposal would cover all families or all children born in the U.S., but the deposits would be larger for babies from lower wealth position homes, so it would be progressive in that way.
And the big questions policymakers should think about when they're deciding to take on baby bonds, I know you have the components. If the components are kind of similar in that regard, then maybe we could stay away from it. But are there any other big, I guess, ticket ideas that we should be thinking about as we're thinking about this policy?
Yeah, I would say, you know, there's a decision about whether to have annual deposits. As I mentioned, that's not included in this proposal in Connecticut and you know, not in most other places. Annual deposits would mean more opportunities for the funds to grow. There's also questions about whether the, you know, how the, I mean, the flexible use of funds, most places are pretty similar in terms of how the funds can be used. Some add training outside of higher education, some add retirement, and others don't. So I would say those are things that could be taken under consideration.
I'm going to give a very hard task right now to Diedrich. I'm giving him the ball and have him do a try here. We got about 60 seconds left, less in the segment. You get the last question. Could Connecticut's baby bonds program, and it's a loaded one, Diedrich, can it position the state as a national leader in both combating child poverty and narrowing the racial wealth gap? Do you think other states can follow suit?
I love the rugby reference, and I will answer yes. Actually, I do think Connecticut can be a leader, and I hope one of the ways it leads, I think there's much opportunity to expand this program, because wealth inequality isn't just a problem for the lowest 20%. You know, we know that white high school graduates have in general about twice the wealth of Blacks and Latinos with a college degree. So I think if we can move this type of investment up a little bit, because those who actually have a little bit more income can even better utilize this type of asset for wealth development. But I definitely think Connecticut has put itself at the forefront, and I'm hoping other states can look and build off of that.
From Connecticut Public, you're listening to The Wheelhouse. This was a absolutely impressive conversation on baby bonds, not just in Connecticut, but beyond. Ginny Monk to my left in studio from the Connecticut Mirror, thank you for coming on. Afronima Bew from the Urban Institute, thank you for joining us. And Diedrich Asante Mohammed, Chief of Organizing Policy and Equity at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Join the conversation, 888-720-9677. When we get back, the end of the COVID emergency.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In-Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. After more than 3 years, Connecticut's COVID health emergency, it's over. The public health emergency ended on Thursday, May 11th, the same day that the federal public health emergency expired. So what will this mean for Connecticut residents? Thank God I've got Sujata Srinivasan to my left in the studio to help us out with this, because you've been covering it there and beyond the last 3 years.
Morning, Frankie. I'm smiling. So it's a sort of an indication that there is a sense of relief that the public health emergency is over. I mean, of course, we know that COVID is not. And it's over coinciding with the fact that the numbers have been coming down. Hospitalizations have been right now at the lowest point since the summer of 2021. And knock on wood,
Love radio sounds. Love that.
In the last 7 days, the data update from the public health department, no one has died in Connecticut as a result of COVID. Also, the numbers of those infected with COVID have been coming down. Last 7 days, it's 251 who tested positive. But in the first week of January, right after the holidays in 2021, it was more than 12,000 people. So the officials believe that we are now at a place where the pandemic itself in Connecticut is in the rearview mirror, even though COVID itself is not.
Is it endemic?
It is. But it really depends on who you ask and which part of the world you're in. Our health commissioner, Dr. Manisha Jethani, you know, I asked her this very question at the press conference a day before the officials ended the PHE. I said, would you say it's in the endemic stage? And she said, yes, I would. And this is what, you know, she says. It's... she says it's in the endemic stage where we are at a point now where we can look at COVID-19 with regard to seasonal numbers the way we do for the flu. I mean, no way could the two be compared, but we would approach it in a certain way where we sort of look at it as a baseline where we reconcile with the number of facts, you know, the fact that every year at this time of the year, we're going to have these many cases of COVID-19 and, you know, the predictable cases that as a society we have to settle for in the number of deaths, like the way we do for the flu.
888-720-WNPR, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677. 77. If you'd like to call us right now and share your questions or concerns, I'm sure there's a lot of folks out there who are still concerned about COVID-19. Maybe they're immunocompromised. Maybe they have some questions they'd like us to help them through right now. I know it's a tough time for that community because the threat of COVID still looms. As we saw, yes, the numbers have been good recently, but right around the time the COVID emergency ended, about a week before that, a couple of people died in Connecticut. But nationally, Sujata, I saw in your reporting, I think it's something like 80% fall off in deaths from COVID, something like that?
Correct.
Yeah.
And in Connecticut itself, I mean, you know, more than 12,300 people have died in our state as a result of COVID. But you're right. I mean, this group of immunocompromised people, this group of long COVID patients, mm-hmm. I mean, Yale continues to do an effective study. It's ongoing. It's called LISN as in here. People can look it up. And those with long COVID might want to take a look at that study and perhaps even consider being a part of it. We've had people contacting us. A listener wrote to me, you know, really worried about what is going to be the masking protocol at cancer hospitals. You know, people go into these facilities immunocompromised. And I've been worried about the health equity part of it that really stood out in stark contrast through COVID. I mean, we saw in 2020 the death rate spike for African Americans, for Hispanic people, and you know, people living in multi-generational homes, people living in multi-family homes, commuting, you know, taking public transportation. So my worry is, you know, what would be the spread, especially in winter, for vulnerable populations.
So we're being super clear here. The end of the COVID-19 public health emergency, endemic, we're getting closer to the endemic stages, but not the end of COVID-19, I would just imagine.
No, in fact, just on Monday, the World Health Organization chief worried, you know, he said the end of, and I begin quote, the end of COVID-19 as a global health emergency is not the end of COVID-19 as a global health threat. We are seeing mutations. I mean, right now the mutations are mild enough, and the Connecticut Health Department will continue to monitor wastewater sewage to look for mutations even after the PHE has ended. Even though they will put out the data on a seasonal basis, the research the kind of looking out for the next wave is going to go on. And there's always the threat of a variant emerging, and goodness, we don't even want to think about it, but an even deadlier pathogen emerging. Globally, we've lost about 6.9 million lives to COVID, and that's just the reported data.
And not just there in terms of wastewater management here, what other ways is the state going to be tracking this?
Right now people have not been, and they're not going to be calling into their local health departments. We don't know who's walking around with COVID. People themselves might not know. They could be asymptomatic. And then with the PHE ending, it's basically what's happening is even though COVID is there and COVID's going to be around for the foreseeable future, what's changed is the government response to COVID. So no longer are we going to have the financial social safety nets that we did throughout the pandemic. So for example, insurance is going to, they're no longer required to cover, take-home test kits, COVID test kits. Changes are expected. The cost is going to go up for everyone. So basically, testing and access and preventive care and even treatment costs are going to go up now. What's happening is, for example, in terms of insurance coverage, so insurance no longer required to cover at-home tests. It changes to Paxlovid, Lagevrio. These are outpatient treatment for COVID. There's an end to 20% Medicaid payment increase for COVID hospitalizations. Mm-hmm. And Medicaid will continue to fully cover treatments until September of next year. And then after that, things normalize there. So I've been talking to infectious disease experts in Connecticut. I'm going to continue to talk to them. We have long COVID, and every day JAMA puts out some paper or the other on COVID's impact. They're finding out on heart health, on kidney health, on even cancer, on insulin. So, research is ongoing. And I spoke to Dr. Scott Roberts at Yale, and he worries about a winter surge, but he worries even more that costs are going to go up for testing, for prevention and treatment, and that's going to prevent folks from accessing all of this.
That next potential pandemic, are they so we're watching out for mutations, we're watching out in wastewater. How's Munisha Jutani and the Department of Public Health kind of monitoring, not necessarily monitoring COVID, but how are they, I guess, preparing in case that next pandemic potential wave does come?
Yeah, so Dr. Jutani and Dr. Deirdre Gifford of the Office of Health Strategy, they say that there's ventilation investments in our schools. Something as simple as putting on, a ventilation system, a fan in a room. Officials learned during the process how important that is. So $165 million invested in schools for ventilation, another $150 million recently announced. And statewide, they've put out some data on all of the PPE that's now in stockpile. There's and also medication, 30,000 medication courses, 16 million gloves, more than 9 million gowns, 6.4 million N95 masks, 9 million surgical masks. So all of that is there. When in the beginning of the pandemic, they were scrambling to get all this from out of state and overseas.
What else, people in the Connecticut, what should they be concerned about following the expiration of the COVID emergency? One thing I'll say is that I understand now there was a waiver that people were enjoying for WIC in the state, the ability for people to get some support in grocery stores and things like that to help pay for your items. That waiver, I understand, gone.
Yes.
And what other things are we looking at here?
Well, we're also looking at Medicaid disenrollments. That was not tied to the PHE ending. Initially it wasn't, then it was not. But then the Medicaid disenrollment has already started in Connecticut, and we're going to be seeing people lose their insurance for procedural reasons. So that's going on as well. So the number one thing that people should keep in mind, and this is what health officials emphasized over and over again at the press conference and whenever I talk to them, is booster shots. So insurance is not going to cover vaccinations out of network going forward. But booster shots are something that the state would be continuing to promote. And it's officials say, they point to data that shows it's one of the most effective ways to minimize spread, but also minimize the severity of the virus itself.
Sujatha Srinivasan recently went to India with her family, beautiful trip, and comes back and has hit the ground running like she never left. Thank you so much for your work on this. I appreciate it, Sujatha.
Absolutely, Frankie. Always a journalist. We all are that way.
Oh, my God. And I could tell from your reporting over there while you were in India. Tremendous stuff.
You're kind.
Download The Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. Today's show, produced by the wonderful Meg Dalton. Thank you so much for this program. It was a great one today. Technical producer, Kat Pastor. Thanks to Tess Terrible for helping us in studio today. I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse. Thank you for listening.